Oh, hello there. This is Fran, your co-host for this music podcast, Over Underrated. And today's episode, we are looking at post-punk from the 1980s, late 70s, with U2 and the Psychedelic Furs. As always, we had two playlists, one to use to discuss are U2 overrated, and one to discuss if the Psychedelic Furs are underrated, with a mix of the hits and some of the album tracks, and even a few B-sides for good measure. And the whole podcast isn't about whether Bono is a cock. We try and think about the band as a whole, but we will chat more about this later on. So please enjoy another episode of our music podcast. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to the Over Underrated podcast with Fran and Babs. Is it over or underrated?
Welcome back to another series of Over Underrated with Fran and Babs. This is I, Fran, and welcome to a post-punk extravaganza. How are you doing, Babs, in Belgium?
I am okay, Fran, and excited about this post-punk extravaganza, a theme that we absolutely decided in advance and didn't just agree on literally a minute before this record.
People listening, what is the difference between new wave and post-punk? Let us know on social media or by Gmail.
Indeed. I would say guitars, synths, quite simply put. But although you do make an interesting comment that I'm going to come back to later in the episode. But how have you been music-wise, Fran? Have you been to any good gigs or festivals since we last met?
So I was supposed to see a band last night called Jealous Nostril.
Oh, have you mentioned them before?
I might have mentioned them before because it is Johnny Burrell from Raised Light's new band with the bass player from the Mystery Jets and somebody else. I apologise to those artists for forgetting the names. And so, yeah, they're playing with Joiners, which is a very famous small venue in Southampton. And I thought it'd be interesting to see him in his new band, so I would check him out. And they have delayed it. I don't know if it's down to ticket sales or what, but I'll be waiting until late August, early September to see Jealous Nostril.
Yes, I have just looked them up and I posted about them in October 2022 on God's Jukebox with the caption, "Phrases I didn't think I'd be saying in 2022. Johnny Burrell's new side project has released quite a good song." The song being Phase 6. So you must have told me about this. I don't think I would have.
And that is unorganically. And 6 months later, or no, sorry, 8 months later, they're still doing the song I've heard. So.
Oh, right. Okay.
It would be an education for me, but alas, I will wait and get back to you if they're any good. So have you seen anyone recently?
I have. I saw the absolutely phenomenal Sparks last month in Brussels. It was such a good experience. It was in one of the venues that I hate the most in Brussels, Cirque Royal, because it's a seated venue. And also quite bizarrely, especially for a concert where, you know, a lot of the audience was older, let's say. It's a place that when the lights are down and you're in the kind of bottom of it, when you're trying to go to the seats in the front rows, there is a step and there is no like fluorescent light or anything. And I saw so many people trip up or like almost fall over holding their beers. I was just thinking like, this is so, so bizarre. But yeah, it was amazing because it was a gig that did start with like everyone seated, but then the Sparks got more and more people going. And then by the end, everyone was on their feet for all of it. And yeah, just incredible. I cannot believe how good Russell's voice sounds for him being 74. Mm-hmm. It sounds the same. He has so much energy, always jumping around. Ron also does it, you know, a little bit now. He sings the song and does a dance, which is very entertaining. And yeah, it was really, really euphoric. They really were one of the best gigs I've seen in a while.
I saw them at Glastonbury.
On the TV.
On the TV.
Yeah.
The last time I saw them was with Franz Ferdinand. I was surprised about how much new stuff they played. Considering it's Glastonbury, usually they kind of play the back catalogue. But yeah, he sounds amazing, doesn't he?
Yeah. No Cate Blanchett in Brussels, unfortunately. But no. Yeah, but supported by, I have to give a shout out to Mr. B, the Gentleman Rhymer, who is a friend of a future guest probably coming on. And so he was supporting Sparks. And the last time I saw him was at my friend's wedding where he was the entertainment. So it was a very different context. I was seeing him in this time. So
did you say which one was a bigger achievement for him?
Well, do you know what? The wedding was far more intimate and there was a lot more jumping up and down because actually, Sia Khoya, I'm going to call you out once more. They advertised the concert as starting at 8, but he was on at 7:30. I think it was like doors at 8 and then Sparks were on at 8:30. So unfortunately, there was only maybe half the audience in there to see him, which was really silly.
Well, that is silly. And I've been burnt many times by bands changing the last minute. I think there's a band called Jean.
Yes.
And I went to the farewell show and like it was trains, planes and automobiles for me to get there. I had a car like pouring up black smoke for like 2 hours.
Oh, God.
And eventually arrived at the Astoria, which I think is also about to close down. And then they decided to come on stage at 8 o'clock. What the fuck? So I missed the first half an hour of Gene.
That's frustrating. See, I don't know how it is in England, but I feel like with most venues, they will put the timings on Facebook. So if, as long as you go on the Facebook page for the event, it will literally tell you like doors, support act, bands sometimes end. And I checked the website and I checked the Facebook event for Sihuel and nothing. So, I mean, come on. And yeah, people were complaining. I'm like, yeah, like we are in the age of the internet.
I know. It is a bit shitty, like especially like for traveling a long distance to not know like what time the support.
There were people from other countries coming. So it's like, yeah. It's like,
they must know like a day before, surely, what time they. Yeah. That, yeah, I did. I'm always literally having to phone the venues still to ask them what time.
Really?
Yeah, because sometimes if I'm reviewing it, I have to ask them if I'm on the fucking guest list because I've driven like 2 hours and got there and then had some awkward phone calls. And then two, I then ask, you know, can you give me the fucking stage time, please?
Yeah.
I can get them on time. But yeah, it's ridiculous. I don't know if it's some sort of ego thing or, you know, it's a mystery. When will we arrive?
I think it's disorganization. It's just like, right, they booked the concert first. They said 8 p.m. Or maybe, you know, when the concert was booked, they didn't have a support act, but now they have a support act. So, but yeah, that's it. I did go for 7:30 because I couldn't find the information. I was like, for sure, like bands in Belgium, normally like it starts at 8:30, not 9. So I was like, let me go a little bit earlier and see. So.
Overrated.
We are discussing as overrated, the Irish giants of U2. And underrated, the lesser giants of London, the Psychedelic Furs. And as tradition, we shall start with the bigger of the two, with you two. I don't mean to rhyme two twice there, as you do. So, Babs, shall I ask you to tell me all of your deepest thoughts about the band U2?
My thoughts on U2, I think they have some really great songs across many years. Always impressed by a band with the original lineup for so long. Obviously, I have not seen them live, but I've heard they're meant to be amazing live. I do understand why people think Bono is a bit annoying, even though I do think sometimes he gets a bit too much stick. And I thought that was a bit of a lesson for everyone when, you know, everyone kept making fun of Bono and his sunglasses, and it turns out he's got glaucoma. And that's why he wears sunglasses all the time. So it's like, yeah, let's stop judging people by their appearances. So I came into this hoping to discover a bit more of their back catalogue, because I think the only album I own is All That You Can't Leave Behind, because, you know, the singles on there were in heavy rotation when I was a teenager. And my parents had the 1980 to 1990 and 1990 to 2000 greatest hits. So that's kind of my exposure to them. So kind of, yeah, early 80s U2. Early 90s U2, I'm not so knowledgeable about, and I know that there are some tracks on there, so I'm looking forward to getting into it.
I basically tried to do a song for each album, and I wanted to be fair, so I chose big hits, album tracks, and B-sides, and live tracks to have a variety of U2. I ended after 2005, because even me as a U2 fan can't really pretend to like the last 20 years of their music. I have not seen U2 live. I've tried.
I'm shocked.
But I will say that I don't think I will now, because I'm sad. I think Bono's voice is gone. And they did like 40 songs. I think it's called Surrender, came out like this year, when they just basically did like piano and acoustic versions of the songs, and his voice is gone. That's sad. So if I did see him, I think it would be, you know, disappointing. Unfortunately, I should have seen them in their prime, but that's not going to happen. So yeah, I mean, I probably own maybe like 5 or 6 U2 albums. A good friend of mine was an avid U2 fan, so he kind of like forced them on me. but like growing up, I don't know why, but for some reason I thought U2 were like a band who are like for better people or something. Like, you know, really? If it's like Giants, you think they grew up, you think, oh no, wow, but that's a great band. But like, you know, little me, who doesn't know much about music, I start with someone small, you know, like I don't feel like I can belong to you two. They're too grandiose for me. Like, I can't live in a mansion. I'll live in a hut, but one day maybe I can live in a mansion. So I had that sort of feel with like you two. I don't mind. That's my feelings. So it took me a while to really get into the back catalogue. And yeah, I mean, I'm always, when I meet people generally who are under 30 who'd instantly say, I hate you too, I'm like, is that because you've read that on the internet?
Because you got that album shoved down your throat on iTunes? Oh,
yeah. Well, yeah, I was like, yeah, unfortunately, like, I even read Bono's autobiography this month and I had to stop. Because if you want to find out about YouTube music gigs, etc., that's fine until the 90s, and then it's all about I met Bill Clinton, I met the Pope, I met Obama, I went to his house to have a chat, and it's literally he does not mention any music after 2000, and I'm like, fucking hell, I don't care anymore. So I gave up around 2009. But yeah, and that's, I think that's one of the reasons why people hate U2. It's not U2 music. It's because of, I guess, Bono, maybe. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I guess if you're young and you've only listened to YouTube in the past 20 years, then yeah, they're not great. But I mean, you know, I always trust a band who keep testing themselves. Mm-hmm. Great live. And you can't say that U2 have not changed since 1980.
No, absolutely not. And yeah, I like some of their early 2000s stuff. Like I said, I do own All That You Can't Leave Behind, and I think Vertigo is a banger. That thing of divorcing the personality of the lead singer from the music. I mean, yeah, we also did talk about this in advance. I sent Fran the video of Bill Bailey doing comedy about the Edge's guitar sound, basically making the point that, you know, his sound sounds good because there's so many effects, but actually when you take everything off, it's just like and I think it's kind of fair, but it also doesn't mean that he's totally slagging the music off, right? Like, it is just an observation that it is something with lots of effects, and you know, it is an undeniable signature sound. But I think any successful band that talks a lot about world peace and that kind of stuff, it does feel a little bit like preachy, I suppose. So yeah, but what I found interesting is, and we'll get into it when it comes to that album, there was a period already in the 80s where people were saying, oh, this is so overblown and self-aggrandizing. So I was like, oh, it's not just a recent thing. Like, people were also saying this in the 80s, so.
Yeah, ever since he did Sunday Bloody Sunday, you know, he's divided people's reactions. But I do feel slightly, because I think The Edge is all about the music. You know, and I feel like, you know, a lot of time, you know, the rest of the band are sitting there waiting for Bono to return from the White House or whatever to actually get back to music. And maybe that's why their music is not strong, because, you know, the first 20 years, I think U2 were absorbing a lot of music, trying to think about what they're going to do next. And maybe after the noughties, Bono had more to deal with rather than just music. So it was, and I'll do an album in a couple of years.
But it just goes back to that thing of like, when you've been so famous for that long, like, in a way, it doesn't surprise me that you kind of want to write music about the world, because you travel the world, you see a lot of stuff that's going on. But I think it's very difficult to do it authentically when you're that famous and rich as well. So like I said, Vertigo, a banger. More like that, please.
Yeah, I mean, that album is How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. I would say it's their last good album. I listened back to all of their albums recently, and there's two or three songs, but even those songs just sound like watered down versions of other classics. But then, you know, that's quite similar to a lot of bands. Most bands after 20 years, it's hard to keep being creative. I mean, we mentioned Sparks; they're one of the few.
Yeah, they're the exception.
but most bands, unfortunately, they after 10 or 20 years, they kind of run out of new. But that's fine. I mean,
yeah. I mean, just to quickly go to Sparks. Yeah. I fucking love The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte. Like, just that's it. They don't need to be inspired by Miss Sarajevo or whoever it is.
But then again, maybe because Sparks never had that success, they feel like they can experiment still because they're not playing to a stadium or people. So maybe it's that. But yeah, so you know, I'm always having to defend U2 and Radiohead to people.
You have to defend Radiohead. Yeah, well, I guess.
People who got into Radiohead, the first thing they heard was Kid A. You know.
Oh, okay. I mean, so those are kind of older people then.
No, I mean, like, say, obviously, yeah, when I was working in a record store, people had never, ever heard of the Bends. Like, they thought they were a boring, weird band. I just had to pay the Bends, and again, was this
madness?
Just Radiohead. I said, yeah, they were a rock band, you know?
Like, because they were moderately successful with the Bends. That's...
Yeah, I guess because, like, some of the biggest hits that you hear is kind of sad. It is things like No Surprises, Karma Police. Mm. So you might think they are a droney kind of, yeah, it's a drone. But they tend to have the, like, justice isn't really paid on the radio over here. So maybe that's completely on the rail of the other side of the Radiohead. And it's like U2, you know, U2, you never hear anything from the first three albums. A lot of people have no idea. Like, that's why I put on Electric Coat, because I don't think people are aware of, like, the post-punk angular sounds, you know?
Well, yeah, that's your first pick, so maybe we can go into it.
Over-underrated.
Starting with 1980 with Boy, and yeah, this was a band who basically wanted to be a punk band, and you know, the influence were Joy Division and The Clash, and you know, they would come to London to try and get signed, and then yeah, I think the only song people may know is I Will Follow.
I do not know it.
So I Will Follow, I think, is still a track they will play maybe occasionally on tour. But so Electric Co is like this fast, choppy, edgy guitar. I don't know if that's why he got named The Edge. It's a abbreviation for electric convulsion therapy, because a friend of theirs was having electric shock treatment in Dublin and it almost killed him. So they wrote a song about it. But yeah, famously, they did a tour of America, I think, ending with Red Rocks, which is a kind of infamous like outdoor venue in America. And they recorded a live album and video there. There's a lot of flag waving at the time. And, you know, Bono is on about, hey, the only flag that matters is the white flag. But this is a live version, mainly because I just love the Edge guitar playing and Adam's bass playing. I think it shows them as being, you know, this isn't a band who are bombastic. It shows, you know, they can actually play, they're tight. And yeah, it's got so much energy to it. I just feel like it's been hidden away. But to me, this is a great guitar riff in its shambolic post-punk rock, and I love it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about why you picked the live version from Under a Blood Red Sky as opposed to the studio version from Boy. I was not expecting this sound. I think Bono's voice sounds fantastic on this version. And I really wasn't expecting the kind of long instrumental bit or the guitar solo or the bass to be so driving. But yeah, I think for me, I enjoyed it, but it didn't leave me gagging to listen to this song more than twice, basically. But my research for the U2 section was basically reading up about the albums. I haven't really listened to any interviews or anything else. So it was interesting to read that for Boy, it was meant to be produced by Martin Hannett of Joy Division fame, but they didn't get on with him and they had to be like, please give us someone else. And that someone else turned out to be Steve Lillywhite, right, who then became the kind of long-term collaborator. And I enjoyed reading about how Lillywhite employed non-standard production techniques, such as recording drummer Larry Mullen Jr. playing in a stairwell and recording smash bottles and cutlery skimmed against a spinning bicycle wheel. Yes, please. Love that kind of geeky shit.
Yeah, I think Steve was a massive drum geek, so... on both the bands we're talking about, there's a lot of it's very heavily drumming. So yeah, so
yes.
But yeah, it's interesting to listen to Boy. I think, you know, if you think of U2 as Beautiful Day, then this is a completely different direction. Yeah, I can't stand Sweet Thing, but completely different direction. It's where, and you know, it's more in common with bands like Block Party and that sort of thing than, you know, bands like Coldplay, to be fair. So moving on to my next pick, and I am going to another U2 pop song from 1983's War. And I would probably say this is... got their most radio-friendly chorus that people haven't heard, because barely anyone I know has ever heard of Two Hearts. I don't even think it's on the Best Of.
No, I don't think it is. Yeah,
but it was a, well, and it's a glorious single. But yeah, this again is about Adam's bass and shredded guitar, and I just love hearing Bono saying "I can't stop the dance." But yeah, I mean, this, they made an album called Pop in 1997, and this, it needed more songs like this. Mm. And I don't think that you two have really written a song with a strong pop chorus like this again, to be fair. So I wanted to show another side, because obviously this came out, you know, same time as Sunday Bloody Sunday, so it's quite a different side to the coin, to be fair. But what's your thoughts on Two Hearts Beating as One?
Well, my initial thought actually was like, don't you think that With or Without You has a chorus, okay, not poppy in kind of like upbeat way, but I think they've got some catchy... I've got some catchy songs with catchy choruses. But anyway, yeah, I loved how post-punky and funky it sounds at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you on Adam's bass. I love how invested Bono's voice is. Like, you really feel the passion. And I think, yeah, as anyone who knows kind of more recent U2 songs, you definitely don't feel that in the same way in the kind of 2000s stuff. But I did write before knowing that you're going to say this, the chorus is a bit too poppy for me. And yeah, my favorite fact about the album This Comes From War was that three of the tracks featured backing vocals by the Coconuts of King Creole and the Coconuts, who happened to be in Dublin on tour, which is like, that's a very different backing vocalists there.
It's almost as if I found them down the pub. But hey, guys, come back to the studio.
imagine you two covering Annie, I'm Not Your Daddy. I would be down for that in a very serious, with the edge guitar.
But yeah, I mean, back to Two Hearts. I can imagine that even Duran Duran would think a version of Two Hearts if it is that mm-hmm. poppy. But yeah, so skipping away from the trilogy of having of Boy October and War. I skipped October because I think it's possibly their worst ever album.
Mm-hmm.
So we're now moving on to the widescreen version of YouTube, what people will be aware of, and that they worked with Brian Eno for the first time.
So can I just say, I had absolutely no idea that Brian Eno was involved with YouTube in any capacity. Wow, and it turns out he's produced a shit ton of their albums. I was like, oh, this is a lesson. So that's my big music lesson for this week, that's for sure. I felt very like, oh God, right, okay. It's not just David Bowie and Microsoft sounds. Okay.
Yeah, I think I heard Ronnie's name through you too. Like that, he was always linked to him, especially like during Act on Baby. And then later on, I found that, oh yeah, he was in Roxy Music.
Yeah, interesting, right?
Yeah, obviously, as I said before, they wanted to try new things. They wanted to get away from the post-punk sound, have some more ambient sounds, and Unforgettable Fire recorded, I think, in a castle. But yeah, Eno's brings on that ambient sound. It's got these weird space sort of melodies. In my head, I can't tell sometimes if it's a guitar or a synth in the backing of it. It's got this like filmic, breathy backing vocals. It's got this huge chorus and a beautiful middle eight, which can give me chills on the right day. It's got a beautiful cello section. And then this is the band who are basically saying, you know, we want to take over. This is just before they became the stadium band. Even in the video, you know, Bono's gone from waving flags in a vest to wearing a serious jumper, while the rest of the band walk around in snow for no reason. I think Chris Martin, this is his favourite song by them. But yeah, but, no, they blend synths, they blend strings. It's a different U2, and it's quite a decent track. But what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you said pretty much what I wrote down, which is post-punk is gone. Synths and heavy breathing are here. And it was a song that I thought I didn't know until it got to the chorus. And then the walk on by, walk on through, I was like, oh, I have heard this song before. I have absolutely no idea in what context I would have made. I don't know if it's on the greatest hits. I'd have to go and see. But similar for me, criticism to Two Hearts of like, I didn't really like the chorus. I much preferred the intro and the verses. I would say I prefer Two Hearts over this one. And yeah, I read that it's inspired by an art exhibition in Chicago about Hiroshima, some cheery topics there. And that the song evolved from a short piano composition that The Edge did with Jimmy Destri from Blondie, which is interesting. I had no idea, because, you know, when you were talking about U2 and kind of like, you kind of disregard the last 20 years of music, I was thinking, you know, is it because it's just been the four of them for so long? Okay, yeah, they have a producer every now and again, but not always, it seems.
Not always. It's a weird album, though. Like, people say it's their favorite album, but it just feels like a lot of promise, but not a lot of, but nothing that still delivers. And apart from obviously this, and obviously, you know, In the Name of Love, there's nice parts, but it feels a lot, it feels rather unfinished, unfortunately, for me.
Yeah, I have not listened to a U2 album from beginning to end. So, yeah, obviously, that must be a very different experience, just like listening to them on the radio or listening to their greatest hits.
I think that they are a band who do care about the album. It's not like maybe six throwaway songs and two singles, even though I said it feels unfinished, but the album does work from start to finish. It does feel like a piece of work. And I would say that, yeah, up until Pop, all the albums are worth a listen from start to finish. They all have something interesting going on, even if some of the songs don't work as good as others. So moving on to another album that people may have heard of, because I think it sold 25 million albums, and that is The Joshua Tree from 1987. We had a 3-year break for them to play Live Aid and conquer America, and this is their Hello America, We're Gonna Take You Over album. And yeah, they want, I think Ed said that he wanted to make the ultimate live U2 song. So he started, you know, with this rumbling guitar riff that gets longer and longer and bigger. Then the bass comes in, the drums come in, and then Bono's, I'm one of one. And then everyone puts their hands in the air and cries. And I've never experienced that. That's what I imagine what happens in a live gig.
You can imagine.
Apparently they spent half of the Joshua Tree recording was trying to get the song right, because the time signature keeps changing and they couldn't get it to work.
I don't think I noticed that the time signature changes.
And I've got a feeling that Adam's bass isn't even in time at some parts of it. But then I think Ina says it sounds fine. Like, it's fucking the thing.
What, did you read about how in the earlier albums, like, Steve Lillywhite had to like play Adam Clayton's bass parts for him teach him how to play bass? Yeah, because he just couldn't play it well enough, and how he really wanted, I think, for the next album, for Larry Mullen to play with a click track. And he refused, but then he met someone from Sly and the Family Stone who did use one religiously and changed his mind, something like that. So, you know, they were still figuring it out, I think, maybe in 1987.
But I think it's a great bassist.
I think he's got some great bass lines.
He's self-taught. He's punk rock. I think most people know this. This is probably one of their biggest anthems. I think maybe it's overplayed, but there's occasionally, I haven't heard it for a while, and it'll just magically appear on TV and radio, and I'm like, yeah, this is a fucking good song. Have you heard the Pet Shop Boys cover?
This is what I'm gonna say. I've heard the Pet Shop Boys cover way, way more.
Have you really? Than this.
Yes, because I think it was on, like, we were much more of a Pet Shop Boys family than a U2 family. And obviously the Pet Shop Boys one mashes up with Contact My Ass Off of You very well. So actually, it had been a really, really, really long time since I'd heard the U2 version. And I think I must have heard some kind of radio edit or something, because I had absolutely no idea it had that extended kind of organ intro and so much instrumental. Like, for me, it was a kind of 3-minute song, much more epic than I realized. And I've written, Fran, it felt Bruce Springsteen-y, but I didn't mind it. So
what is it that gives it that extra shine? Is it like a piano?
No piano.
No sax.
I'm not usually so bothered about sax, but I think it's the fact that it keeps shifting, like, and probably the Edge's guitar drives it along. Like, it, you never get too bored. And I had no idea what it was about, and I really thought it was quite interesting, the reasoning behind it. So Bono basically said that when you go to Belfast, you can tell a person's religion and how much money they make by knowing the name of the street that they grew up on. And he went to Ethiopia, which obviously a very different place, where sometimes the streets have no name. And then you know, this whole thing about, oh, maybe that's a dream of art to break down the barriers and divisions. So I was like, that's quite a nice, it's quite a nice thought. Again, it does sound a bit like, this is what I am the savior. I am the cultural bringer together of people. But I'm like, oh, that is a nice thought and a point well made.
So moving on to their first UK number one, surprisingly. So Rattle and Hum is a weird album. Some would say studio. Basically, they made a tour film called Rattle and Hum, and the soundtrack they made as a CD. The soundtrack has new material, some live and some covers, which is a fucking just a weird thing. And then it spurred three singles, and Desire was one of them. And yeah, this got to number one, I think, in 1989. And yeah, it's got a bow dizzily din 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 din, as heard later on by Craig McLaughlin from Neighbours with Hey Mona. That's a reference for anyone who's my age.
That reference. Enjoy.
Not no one else apart from Josh Riddicombe.
Josh, let us know if you enjoyed that, yeah?
You're welcome. But for me, it's a bit too basic rock and roll. It's a bit too obvious. I never loved it. I'm surprised this was number one. Maybe it's a shit week that year. This isn't my top 10 songs. I just wanted to sprinkle over different versions. So I thought, well, I've got to put on U2's biggest hit in the UK, which many people may not know was Desire. So what are your thoughts?
I did not know it was their biggest hit in the UK. But actually, yeah, this is one of my more preferred U2 songs. I've put it simple. It's catchy. I'm not annoyed by the harmonica at the end. But when I did go and see that they cite 1969 by the Stooges as the main influence, you're like, oh God, yes, absolutely. Like, have you gone to listen to that song?
No.
Oh my God.
I just heard the Bo Diddley. Dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun. I mean, it's also the Bo Diddley, but I'm guessing that's who the Stooges were inspired by as well, of course, or everyone. Elevating the Black music, being inspired by Black music. But yeah, God, what a great song 1969 is. I hadn't heard that in absolutely ages, but it really is.
Over underrated.
What's your next pick, Fran?
Well, my next pick, I thought, well, my favourite album is Act On Baby. I would probably say that's my top 10 albums of all time. So I thought, do you know what I should do? Is not include any songs from that album at all. And put a B-side because I'm a prick. But as I said before, I wanted to show them in a different way. So Lady With a Spinning Head, it was an early demo before Act On Baby, and they could never complete the song. So if you listen to Lady in Spinning Head, you may hear reference to some other songs that made the album, like The Fly, Ultraviolet and Zoo Station. But it all came from this one track. But I still feel that it worked to me. I love the la 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 lady with a spinning, and I love all the different saxes and synth noises swirling round. It's, yeah, there's an extended dance mix, which I think is better, but it goes on for 8 minutes, and I wanted you not to hate me. So
I would have accepted it. I think sub 10 minutes is okay, as long as it's, not several, but yeah.
But, again, this, how brave is it to be literally the biggest band in the world and then think, nah, fuck it. We're going to be influenced by, European electronic music, and we're going to move to Berlin, and we're going to say, right, I'm going to sing in a completely different way. I'm not going to sing about politics. And I think Adam and Larry were, Larry and Adam were like, fuck. But I think our career is fucked, and they're pushing back the whole time. And the Edge and Bono, as I said before, I think back then they were really, it's all about the music. They cared about music so much that they wanted to keep pushing. I think 10 years later that had changed, their life had changed. But yeah, so I think a lot of people would be surprised if this is a U2 song. But what are your thoughts?
I did a 180 totally on the song. When I heard it, I was like, oh, I absolutely hate this. I enjoyed the effect on Bono's voice and the use of strings, but then it got weird at the end, and I was like, oh, hang on, like, this is actually probably way more interesting than I'm giving it space for. And then it was really weird because it's like it finished, and then I played it again, and it's like the beginning made sense after I listened to the end, and now it was one of my favorites on the list. So yeah, I'm not surprised that it was a B-side, because it's like, yeah, it isn't like an immediate kind of hit. But yeah, I really love the atmosphere that it created. And it's interesting to hear you talk about Achtung Baby, because yeah, I remember hearing that title as an album and thinking like, why Achtung Baby? And only duh, did I make the realization, like, yeah, 91, just after German reunification. And I remember like reading or watching videos about Zoo TV and never understanding it, like why it was called Zoo TV. And there's this like wonderful summary of it on Wikipedia, which is like, The show's incorporated channel surfing, prank calls, video confessionals, a belly dancer, and live satellite transmissions with war-torn Sarajevo. And it's like, what the fuck? What the hell is going on? Like, have you ever watched any kind of live DVDs of Zoo TV?
Yeah, there's one, I think, a couple of years later. Which, it's basically Acton Baby and Europa combined. And mm-hmm. yeah, like, Bono keeps changing his image all the way through. He comes on. I think there's a version of him called Mephisto when he dresses as a devil.
Right. Yes, yes, yes. All in red. Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
And like, I mean, this is like, Bono said, you know, he wasn't, although he's a great performer, he's not an actor or a showman. And he wanted to think, fuck it, I'm going to try and do as much as I can, you know. And mm-hmm. he sings in a hearty falsetto, and he completely changes his voice. And yeah, I just think this is like, it's very rare you can be that interesting and have global success. I mean, yeah, the song obviously isn't, you know, experimental, but the rest of it around it is, you know, inspiring. And when people say The Joshua Tree is the best album by U2, I'd say yes, it's got three great singles, With or Without You, you know, So I Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, but Acton Baby to me from start to finish is just a glorious soundscape. And there's a Q magazine did a 20th anniversary of it, and loads of artists covered a song, and it's one of the best compilations I've ever had. It literally had White Stripes, Depeche Mode, I think Garbage, Goldfrapp. Like, it's got like just 20 brilliant artists discovering all the songs in it, and I highly recommend it. So yeah, if you say you hate U2, listen to Acton Baby and Joshua Tree, and come back to me. If you still hate U2 after that, then fair enough, but at least give them a chance.
Yeah, no, I you've left me keen to go and listen to Acton Baby, I will say.
So moving on to, halfway through their Zoo TV tour, they started to experiment and wanted to do another album. At first, it's going to be an EP with just like six new random tracks. And then they got so inspired, they made an album. And there's Johnny Cash has a song in there called The Wanderer. And yeah, this is even more experimental, probably the most experimental they've ever got. It's got Numb as a single, which is the Ed speaking all the way through it. And then this is Babyface. This has got like this weird childlike piano sort of sound. We've got Bono's falsetto. We've got this driving chorus. I think it's influenced by trip hop. I would say it's got a great distorted guitar, which I wonder if that influenced Garbage maybe. Because this is 93, and I think Europa is a failure. I would say that it's only got five decent songs in it. But again, you know, after having Acton Baby, you're fucking brave to release an album with maybe only one commercial song in it. And yeah, so give it a chance, because this is the band, you know, just saying fuck it, you know, we're going to try and do something different. Some of it doesn't work, but what's your thoughts on Babyface?
So I would like to start by saying that I always thought it was Zurupa, not Zuropa. So I'm glad that you said it out loud.
I don't know.
No, but that makes sense, because it's like Zoo Europa, I'm guessing, right? Yeah. If it's that thing, like literally just the light bulb went off in my head. So thank you, Fran, and boo to my interpretation of spelling, because it's not double O. The childlike piano that you mentioned, do you know who it reminds me of? A band that we've covered before on Heroes Underrated, Andorsheen.
It really reminds me
of Chez Demandé à la Lune or some of the others, where they sometimes have that. It's like, you know, the childlike things that, but also sound a bit spooky when contrasted with other harder stuff. Yeah, this was the most surprising song by far, but I think it works really well. I like the gnarly guitars and the deep bass with that childlike voice. And I like Bono. Is he harmonizing with himself, or is he singing in harmony with someone?
And I see Ed does the backing vocals, so sometimes it's hard stuff, especially when they're putting distortion on the voices. It's like, okay, who's I don't know.
But yeah, reading about Zuropa, like a lot of people called it like a coda to Acton Baby. Mm-hmm. And I guess it was done at a similar time. But like for me, I like this. I don't know if I liked it more than the lady with the spinning head, but this was far more immediate than that. So for me, like honestly, on this playlist, the two albums that I want to go and listen to are Acton Baby and Zuropa. So yeah, I'm surprised that you said it was a failure, because I thought it would be kind of similar-esque to Acton Baby. But if Acton Baby is a kind of perfect album, it's difficult to follow up.
Then. Acton Baby still had killer singles. Like Acton Baby has One, The Fly, even better than The Real Thing.
Not a fan of One. Not a fan of Even Better Than The Real Thing.
Wild Horses. Yeah. So, but obviously, you had these big killer singles. The singles from this was Lemon, which is...
Fucking love Lemon,
yeah,
right?
But people would be like, what the fuck is this? Obviously, he sings completely like Prince the whole way through it.
So, I discovered Lemon, I think, through Q Magazine. I think it was Q Magazine had the Perfecto mix of Lemon, which for me is one of the greatest remixes of all fucking time. Paul Oakenfold doing it. Lemon, I love it. I don't know what Lemon is she's wearing. Is she wearing a big furry hat? I don't fucking know. So I literally actually think I only listened to the original Lemon today for the first time because I just love the remix so much that I put it also because it is on Tidal, but it definitely wasn't on Spotify for a while. Yeah. I don't think so. Maybe I was finding it incorrectly because it's the Perfecto mix, not the Paul Oakenfold. But yes, if you like Bono going under some lovely beats, I do recommend that.
Yeah, mix. Again, like when I first heard Lemon, I thought, what the fuck is this? But now I love it. And I even love Numb. If you want to see The Edge, Tides of Shit.
I have a feeling I've seen... I've heard that's the Edge speaking sounds familiar, so I'll have to go and check it out.
I think I did it on Top of Pops randomly, but and the only sort of like normal sounding song is Stay.
Which is boring.
But I think I think that was left over from Acton Baby, and then they sort of took over. But yeah, that's the only sort of like obvious youth song in the entire album. Apart from that, it's different.
I think what surprised me the most out of kind of this song and the one before, like it feels kind of a little bit Britpoppy, like it doesn't sound a million miles away from the kinds of sounds that would be coming from the Pulps, the Blur. I'm thinking the Pulps more specifically than anything else, but I'm like, oh, like they are kind of reinventing themselves and going with the times a little bit, and it is still early 90s, right? So yeah, wasn't expecting that.
Good. Yeah, so we are moving on to the theme tune to Batman Forever. A disappointing
second film. Batman song on the podcast by a big artist.
And yeah, this is Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me, I believe. Is that the right order? And 1995, not on an album, sadly, although the album Follow This Pop was so needs this album, the song to be on it. So this is maybe the sexiest Bono's been on a recording for me. This could have been a Bond theme. I know in the same year they wrote GoldenEye for Tina Turner, but yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Edwin Bono wrote GoldenEye.
No. Oh. That I'm very surprised about that.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So 95, they wrote two. I mean, this could have been a Bond theme with like the strings and everything as well, you know. But yeah, I think this is one of the. This would be my top 10 U2 singles. And Manson, I've mentioned, the first track on their debut album sounds very much like this as well. I remember like back in the 90s, I remember when Todd Pops had like a premiere, and I remember being really excited to be able to see U2's new song because it had clips for Batman.
Yeah.
And then everything came at once, and it's got a brilliant video of like an animation of U2 mixing the clips of Batman Forever, seeing Valerie Kilmer at his finest. And yeah, I think, yeah, as I said, it's got a beautiful guitar riff, catchy chorus, Craig Armstrong strings. I'm a big Craig Armstrong fan. And I think, yeah, this I don't hear this at all played this day anymore, but I think it's a great single. What are your thoughts?
So my thoughts are that I had seen this song title so many times, but I had never bothered to click on it to listen to it. I don't know, I was just like, oh, I don't know, because maybe it's so long, I was just like, oh, it's too much effort. This is a fucking great song. I was so pleasantly surprised. Love the bass. Can it be a Bond song? I see what you mean with the strings, but I think it's maybe a bit too electronic, although I am thinking of Die Another Day, which was a Bond theme that I did quite enjoy, Sigmund Freud, so maybe. But yeah, like with the others, it feels so 90s, and that's just not a sound I had associated with U2 before. Like, it's clearly, I've put grunge inspired in textures, you know. There is something a little bit kind of menacing about it, and a bit slow and slinky. I'm glad that you made me click on it and listen to it. I really enjoyed the song.
A lot of people on YouTube are saying, I fucking hate U2, but I love this song.
And you can't hate U2, can you, if you like one of their songs?
Well, so moving on to an album you do know, and I thought, shall I play a single? I thought, okay, I'll try an album track. So I think this is my favourite album track, and I believe this is the Edge's favourite song from the album. This is Kite. I believe it's kind of inspired by his father, who was dying of cancer, and about how he never spoke to him, lack of communication. And I think it came from a guitar loop from the Edge, and then he added a slide guitar, and then once the chorus was there, then Bono felt comfortable when he sang Panic for like 6 years. I think he had some vocal issues when he found his voice again on his album. That's why he belts out, "I'm a man, not a child," and screams it out. But if you watched it live at Slane Castle, I think he did it a month after his father passed away, and he slightly changed the lyrics, and then he strums the guitar and he says, "Communication, no, we need communication," because he never really spoke to his dad much about stuff. I think his dad famously told him that to never have a dream because you'd be disappointed. Because he was like a failed one, so he wanted to be an opera singer and he never became an opera singer.
Right, okay.
But there you go, and that's Kite. What are your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. I'm very sorry to say, Fran, that this was one of my least favourites.
Of course you do. You haven't got a heart. That's, I'm
joking. I haven't got a heart.
I'm joking.
I haven't got a heart.
I'm joking.
It's buried deeper underneath in my body. It is a stadium ballady type thing. I mean, I didn't know all that story. Like, I think knowing now what it's about, and if you've seen it live, I'm sure it has more meaning to it. But yeah, I don't really like the song, and I did think his voice sounds very raspy here, so maybe that is why, you know, especially kind of just going through and listening to those early 80s songs that I didn't know, and being like, wow, his voice, wow, his delivery, like the contrast here is quite stark. And I think, you know, one thing that Bono can do sometimes is really make a ballad strong with his voice, and I don't think he does it here, unfortunately. And Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois, or Lanois, however you pronounce it, is still, I just can't believe that they also produced this album.
I know that, like, this was on purpose from going back to basics, because I think pop was a bit of a failure for them.
Right,
and
okay.
So it was like, that's why this is, I guess, the cliche U2 sound. Maybe for me, why I felt a bit off, because obviously, I grew up in the 90s, liking the new version of U2. So when this came out, I was like, oh, you know,
Going back to this now.
I felt like, oh, you've gone back to your love. But so for me, I didn't love this album as much as people said it was. It's maybe why I chose Kite, because I don't know, for me, I like the sort of like electronic loop at the start of it and the ending of it.
Did you read the story about the laptop being taken?
No.
I'll read it direct. So that year, a bag holding personal papers and a laptop containing lyrics for this album was taken from Bono's car, which was parked outside the Clarence Hotel in Dublin. Bono offered a reward of £2,000. An Irish man returned the laptop after having bought it for £300, thinking it was from a reputable source. He realised it was Bono's when he saw a picture of Bono's kid on it, and then got in touch with U2's management and returned it, which I'm like, imagine, you buy like a secondhand computer and then there's a picture of Bono's kid on it.
But how much would that be worth now? But then again, how can you sell it?
Yeah, well, I mean, he probably gave it back and... I don't know if he got a reward from it. I didn't go and click on the source of the Wikipedia bit that said that. Another interesting fact about this album is that it's the only album in history to have multiple tracks win the Grammy Award for Record of the Year, for Beautiful Day in 2001 and Walk On in 2002.
Okay, so moving on to my final track, and as I said, this is the final decent album for me. So again, another song about his father. That was a song pre-death, is a song after death in the morbid view. So this is Sometimes You Can't Make It On Your Own. I believe this won a Grammy for Song of the Year. And yeah, it's a song that stirs emotion. They had it for a long time. And it took Steve Lillywhite, that old friend from the 80s, to tell them that they need to write a chorus. So I think literally he then added the... you know, it's me when you look at the mirror, that bit. And then suddenly thought, oh, it works. And it's a very obvious, maybe U2 ballad. I think they changed the chord structure to make it less obvious, but I like it acoustic. I like it on the piano. I like it in a live environment. I think it's a beautiful ballad. Maybe the last good song they wrote. Dun, dun, dun.
Unfortunately for me, I literally wrote, this is U2 by numbers, I think, as you kind of hinted at. I found it a bit of a boring song. It's not the worst song. Like, I think I prefer this to Kite, for example. And it does build. I think the sometimes you got, that's fine. But everything around it, I'm like, meh. It's too long to build. And unlike Where the Streets Have No Name, where it's like it's building and it's back and forth and constant, and that kind of grips you. This one, I didn't find it grip me, unfortunately.
So yes, I imagine if you were like 14, 15, and you heard this wouldn't be, wouldn't grab many people. This is,
I don't even remember hearing this at the time.
I think this is number one in the UK, this song.
I did know it, but I didn't know it very well. Yeah, maybe it was on the radio every now and again, but maybe we skipped over it.
So yeah, I guess this was the last popular album. I think this Vertigo obviously became the theme tune to the iPod.
Yes.
Which sold, apparently that did really well for them, and like a whole new generation were brought over to the U2 side. But then obviously, you know, they had, is it No Line on the Horizon? I literally looked at the track listing today.
No idea.
I literally couldn't remember how any of it sounds at all.
I just remember Songs of Innocence, like with, is it Larry Mullen?
Yeah.
Holding Someone.
And then Innocence of End is the one which is like the sequel to that. And yeah, I can maybe think of one or two songs. I didn't have an Apple phone, so I didn't cry when they gave me free music. But I kept thinking, I mean, is that the worst thing of your
time? Yeah. It's that thing of like, it was just the thing that you couldn't remove it, right? It was like, fair enough that you want to, but like, I think I remember they had to like create apps to be able to remove it from it. And it's like, that is really, like, you should have that option. And do you remember the apology video that they did where they were like, what I remember from it, I didn't look it up, but it's like, they're all sitting in a circle with their backs to each other, and then Bono's just there being like, yeah, like, we should have thought about this. It was a bit much. But yeah, I did mention it kind of up the top, but with Rattle and Hum, which you mentioned kind of was this weird album, like that was the one where I saw loads, it really divided critics, and they were like, oh, they're so self-aggrandizing. Like, how dare they kind of think that they could do something like this? So I was like, oh, okay, this isn't just a 90s and noughties thing. Like, that tarring you two with that brush started much earlier, which is interesting.
Which I think is another reason why they did change to the new version of U2, because I think that they did get, because that film of Rattle and Hum, but you come across it as a bit too ponderous and a bit boring, and I think that hurt them a little bit. So yeah, that's another reason why they reinvented themselves. But it's nice to know that they even care. A lot of bands wouldn't even fucking give a shit about what the critics said. I haven't mentioned the Passengers album. Do you know about this?
No, I don't.
So after Europa, they made a made-up band called The Passengers, including Brian Eno in the band, and they made a soundtrack to a film that doesn't exist.
Oh, okay, yes, this does sound familiar.
And then the only song you may know is Miss Sarajevo. They did a Pavarotti.
So that wasn't a U2 song?
No, it's officially The Passengers. And I think Larry was like, what the fuck are we doing? Like, what is this? We're making a soundtrack to a film that doesn't exist, and Brian is officially in the band. But yeah, so that's like an unofficial U2 album, but I think it's like, I don't even know if it's on Spotify or anything, to be fair. So that is U2. Do you think U2 deserve to have sold the 135 million albums?
Fucking hell.
But it's just interesting. We mentioned album sales. Is that like dead now? Like, is that up to 2010?
Well, I, of course, Fran, did my homework, and they have 20 million plus monthly listeners on Spotify. Mm. They're 284th, which is a bit lower than I thought they would be, because I mean, they are one of the best known rock bands in the world. If you're going to ask me the question, from this playlist, I think they're overrated, because I think there were definitely some new parts of U2 that I enjoyed getting to know, especially acting maybe in Zeropa. And even though, you know, I'm not dying to listen to them again or save them, I did enjoy the early 80s. But yeah, for a 10-track playlist, for me to only get excited about three of the songs, well, Desire I knew already and I enjoyed, let's say, three of the new songs, I would say overrated. But they have so many different sounds, and they have got so many songs that I do love, that I'm sure there's a 20-track U2, 30-track U2 playlist that I would think would be perfect. So yeah, maybe one day I will try and make it when I have the patience, because how many bloody albums do they have?
I think, yeah, is it 14 albums?
Okay, not as many as I thought.
Yeah, so for me, I think from 1980 to 2005, I would say they're a 4-star band.
I will finish with, no, I have one more very important, very, very important thing to say, which is the Electrical Storm music video with Larry Mullen Jr. and Samantha Morton is sexy as hell, people. If you don't know it, go and check it out.
Yeah, another song which has been lost in...
That's one of my favourites. That's one of my favourites. But see, I remember that music video being on, and I think that was a song for their Greatest Hits album. So I do remember that being...
William Orbit produced it, I believe, when he was popular back in those days.
Well, they do Madonna and U2. Love it.
That's the end of part one.
Do you listen to albums start to finish? Do you love concept albums? Are you always the first one at a party to bring up King Gizzard? Say no more. The Album Concept Hour podcast has everything you need. We have hot takes.
It's like Voltron.
It's just like Voltron. Ah. It's like Voltron with jazz. This is emo. This is Willie Nelson's emo trip. Bad improv attempts.
That was
Let's all
British.
Do our best Aussie accent.
Let's not.
Let's alienate all the Australians.
And sometimes we even learn something. As they listened again and again to the song in the control room, Axel started saying, "Where do we go? Where do we go now? Where do we go?"
Shut up.
Spencer turned down the music and said, "Why don't you just try singing that?" And thus the last part of the song was born. Listen to the Album Concept Hour wherever you listen to podcasts.
Underrated.
Goodbye, you two, and hello, Psychedelic Furs. So, Babs, I will ask you, tell me everything you know about Psychedelic Furs in a small soundbite of less than 5 minutes.
Oh, fuck. Okay, the pressure is on. So, I had saved 4 songs by Psychedelic Furs in 2016, 2017, 2018, and 2020. I had no memory of doing this because I thought Psychedelic Furs were one of those bands that I would go check out, be like, it is not so much for me. Probably because I would listen to Pretty in Pink only. Mm-hmm. But then I was like, oh no, God, I have made a bit of an effort and I clearly enjoyed more songs than I thought. And 2 of those songs are on your list and I will tell you which ones they are when they come up. So I knew that they were linked, obviously, to Pretty in Pink. I did not realise they were English. I presumed they were American because of being linked to Pretty in Pink. And yeah, you mentioned that they are a London band, but the Butlers were actually born in Kingston upon Thames. Shout out. That's down the road from me in Epsom where I grew up. Shout out Bentall Centre. That's where I remember the shopping centre. And I hadn't realised that it was Richard Butler who did Love Spit Love, who formed them when they were on a hiatus.
And Tim.
Oh, and Tim as well. Okay. Yeah. And they did a very good version of How Soon Is Now, which was in number one, The Craft, and number two, Charmed. It was the theme tune. I had no idea it was these guys who I thought were American in the first place. Honestly, you would How Soon Is Now, you would think it's a song that's uncoverable, and yet Tattoo and for Love did a decent job. Who would have thought? And basically, that was literally, this is all I know coming in. I guess that they, because it was an 80s band that you liked, I thought it was going to be new wavy, but they are also post-punky, for sure.
Yeah, so again, I think the first time I heard them was Pretty in Pink, and I thought they were like a punk band and I hadn't heard of. And again, when did I get into the Psychedelic Furs? I think I must have heard Love My Way, and then that's... And I think I bought a best of like £3. I used to do, if I saw like a best of like a couple of pounds and I liked 2 songs, I thought, yeah, give it a try.
That's such a good tactic for discovering music. Yeah.
I guess it's like, you know, that'd be like putting on the playlist these days. But yeah, so I used to buy a lot of best ofs. And then like then in the UK, like, yeah, apart from Pretty in Pink, they have no hits. Like, there's no top 20 hits, I don't think, at all. And I didn't know how many albums they made, didn't they? That they were kind of bigger in America. And then I bought their best of, and then slowly I started to buy the albums one by one. And I was like, this band is really fucking interesting. Why are they not, like, I know of The Cure had a lot more bigger pop songs, but it felt strange how this band were kind of like just, you know, oh yeah, by the way, there's a band called Psychedelic Furs. And then I think in the mid-noughties, The Killers would name-check them quite a lot. And then more and more, like, bigger bands. I know the Foo Fighters have covered them. On the Clueless soundtrack, Cat and Crows covered them. And it's all American bands. And then, and then looking at it, the Butlers moved to New York in 1984.
There we go. Okay, because that makes a lot of sense.
They said they were getting more traction in the live scene than they were in the UK.
And then, so interesting. Like, how rare is that, that an English band would be bigger in America than in the UK? I feel like that doesn't happen very often. Like, some, I don't, you have like the Radioheads that will have like the college radio following, but for it to be that different on a live version, that's really interesting.
So at the end of a band I know who was similar to the Flock of Seagulls randomly were quite big in America compared to the UK.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know why that was.
It's the haircut.
Yeah, so yeah, so they moved to America. I mean, mostly a success. They weren't like, I don't think they even had a top 40 album in America, but I think they could tour and make money. So yeah, they moved to New York and they worked with like Todd Rundgren, who's a legend. Yeah, and then I think they called it quits. In the early 90s, as you said, they then tried a different version, and Love Spit Love is kind of a more grungy version of Psychedelic Furs. And the drummer and guitar player are now in Guns N' Roses.
I did not know that. So were they at Glastonbury?
Yep. The second guitarist and the drummer were in Love Spit Love. And then
that is not an association I would make.
And we're in the Psychedelic Furs. The last album by Psychedelic Furs is produced. I should probably get his name up because it's quite bad. Yeah. So yeah, Mr. Butler had a association. What is annoying is on Spotify, I don't know about Tidal, they only have the second Love Spit Love album.
Only one album. Try some Eat One.
Yeah, okay. The album beforehand is a lot better, and it's got Am I Wrong is the best one by Love Spit Love. I think Brand New covered it. So Frank Ferrer is the drummer for Guns N' Roses, he's the drummer for Love Spit Love, and Richard Fortus was the guy who was writing songs with Richard Butler, and he also produced the last Psychedelic Furs album of 2020. Yeah, I would enjoy just every few months getting a new Psychedelic Furs album. And,
that's fun, isn't it? When you're kind of, rationing
albums. Yeah, and then slowly, I think it took me a while to discover Love Spit Love. And I'm like, oh, wow, I've got more Psychedelic Furs albums, kind of, with an American twist. And then I saw them play live 2014 in Bristol, and, you know, they were sensational. I saw them last year at the Royal Albert Hall, again, sensational. And like, he's in his like mid-60s, and he's still, you know, how some people just like get embarrassed and get older. He seems as cool now as he was 45 years ago.
That's really cool.
I just think that people compare his voice to Bowie and to John Lydon, but he's got his own rasp.
John Lydon, yeah, I saw that, and I'm like, okay, maybe in delivery, but not in timbre. Like, yeah.
But yeah, you know, I think that's a band that I just need a spotlight shone on, because I don't get how they are dismissed, especially in the UK. Obviously in America, they, I guess, do a little bit better. I don't know how popular they are in mainland Europe. Do you see them ever tour in Belgium?
I really don't know. I feel like Belgium definitely has a lot of love for kind of retro 80s and 90s. I will look up their touring schedule while you introduce the first song, perhaps.
Again, like you two, it's a playlist which basically goes through most of the albums. Their first song on their first album is India. And I thought, well, you know, why not introduce it to Babs? I'm not a big fan of India. I think that the first album is a band trying to discover a sound. They call it Beautiful Chaos, which is when there's six guys just, you know, hammering the guitars, and then occasionally you hear a sax, and occasionally there'll be a keyboard. And then with each album, they would shed members. So the first two albums are six, and then they get down to four, and then they get down to three. This has got like a long intro to kind of enjoy, and then like the tom-tom drums come in, which is why I met Steve Lillywhite. This song is all about the drums, which I think is Vince Ely. And then it takes maybe like 3 or 4 minutes before Butler even starts coming in, and he just sounds like he's barking. And I think India, he said, was like inspired by Americans going to like India to basically do drugs and be like hippies.
Did wonder what it was about. Okay.
Yeah. But it wasn't a single, but it's still a live favourite. For me, it's a bit too, it goes on for far too long for me. But yeah, it's a band discovering themselves, I guess.
So Fran, this is a song I'd saved. Oh, I did previously. I did so know this song.
How did this get on your radar, Ben?
Oh, listen, I have no idea. I have no idea anymore. I have no idea since I got every now. It might be actually, it might be God's Jukebox. Okay. Because if I'm listening to songs on there and I like them, I will just save them. So it is probably that, or probably when I joined Spotify and I was much more active on kind of the Discover Weekly and that kind of thing, and I'd go down rabbit holes. Whereas now I'm like, enough, there is too much music. I do not need these tools anymore to find new music that I like. I was really surprised that you, because I presumed again that you picked like 10 of your favorite songs over the years, because I was like, oh, I bloody love this long intro and what it launches into. And how, yeah, I mean, the intro, I think, is kind of the first third of the song. And you think it's going in a certain direction, and then suddenly it shifts into this yeah, much guitarier song. Although I wondered if you found this listening back, the bass and keyboards, that particular combo towards in, because the bass is quite sort of powerful, really reminded me of the Stranglers. And there's another song that reminds me of the Stranglers. Mm. That sound, which obviously, like, in vocals, not at all, Hugh Cornwell does not sound like this at all. But no, I, you know, loved it when I first saved it back in whenever it was, and really enjoyed listening to it again. But I really had zero memory of this.
Yeah, this is why we're saying post-punk, because it feels more rougher and punkier than, yeah, say, new wave. So,
but like, even so, like, that intro is not, it's quite unusual to have an intro like that that goes on for so long. But no, yeah, I loved it.
So then moving on to their next album, Talk, 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 which is my favourite album by them. And we have Pretty in Pink, but not that one. This is the first version of the dirtier version. And he rants for longer at the end of it. Did anything notice that?
No, I didn't even realise that it was a different version to the other one.
Yeah, the big, like, the film version is cleaner, it's got more polished guitars. And then at the end, I think he basically talks about Caroline, the girl in the thing, about, you know, her having dirty sex and that sort of stuff, and they cut out because basically, I don't know if you know the story behind how it became the film title.
No, it was that the song inspired the film title and not the other way around, right?
So yeah, so John Hughes discovered a song, and then he wrote a film about it, but famously the film is nothing to do with the lyrics about it. But I went along anyway. But he's like, yeah, this is not what I was on about. I think it's on about, like, you know, like a woman who had carnal desires and it's kind of like dirty and stuff, and that is not the prom film you see in 1986.
No, although I guess, yeah, like, it is the kind of the choosing between the two men kind of thing, men, but boys. But yeah.
But yeah, even the title, Pretty in Pink, is basically her naked, is what she's he's referring to.
I had not got that. Thank you for informing me.
But obviously, you know, this is a band who hadn't had a hit. So, you know, when, you know, the guy who did fucking Breakfast Club says, do you want to have a single? They're like, yes, please. We wouldn't mind being successful once. So no. This is the first version, and there's a different video of from 1981 with the band. And yeah, this is the first song I ever heard. It's got that punky. I think now it sounds like Tom Petty. The down, 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 down.
I don't like, know Tom Petty enough to agree.
Like American Girl. And it's got his rasp. It's one of those songs when the verse is better than the chorus.
When is he menacing in it? Because I'm trying to remember the song. I think that's one of the chorus. Yeah, I prefer that.
But yeah, it's probably been overplayed. It's probably the only song most people will know of them, and there's a lot more to them than this, but there you go. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so comparing it to the previous song, obviously it's so much more jingly jangly, and yeah, I think that's this song is why I thought I didn't like anything by the Psychedelic Furs, because I think it would be the first song that I would listen to and be like, ah, this is not really for me. Have you watched Pretty in Pink recently at all?
I remember watching maybe 15 years ago and thinking, oh, this is dated badly. I don't know.
See, this is the thing. See, I remember watching it maybe 10 years ago and not thinking that. But now I'm like, oh my God, probably it has. And have you watched 16 Candles? So we discussed this on the podcast.
I'm aware. Even as like a 10-year-old, I didn't like that. Because I discovered John Hughes when I was about 9 and 10. And I remember liking Breakfast Club and Weird Science, but even 16 Candles then felt weird for me. And now, obviously, getting older, okay, that's because it's racist and it's rapey, and it's like, what the fuck?
So rapey, like, literally, like, it was so funny because it was, we did a film club with some of my friends during lockdown where kind of every week someone would pick a film that would be on Netflix because that was the only platform we all had. And 16 Candles, it was like, one of us watching it was like, guys, like, just prepare yourselves. And then, like, each one of us would, like, live kind of post as we were watching it, like, oh my God, this is so awful. But yeah, I just want to mention that Wild Sex in the Working Class by Ongo Bongo, which I think is from 16 Candles, that is such a banger. And I'm like, the only redeeming feature of the film is that's how I discovered that song. But yeah, Pretty in Pink, unfortunately, more like Melancholy and Mauve for me. Very sorry, that's very bad. I was trying to come up with something.
It's fine.
Oh, dearie me, I'm sorry.
It's fine. So, same album, but this is not a single. This is Into You Like a Train, which I believe is a sexual remark there from The Butler. So again, it's a lot of drumming. We like Lil White likes his drums. It's sax, but not annoying for me. It's got I love the guitars high in the mix. I think people at the time were offended by how sexy the song was and how, you know, dirty it was to sing about someone fucking, but it was about saying, well, you know, people have sex. What's wrong with that, you know?
Like, wasn't James Brown around before then?
Yeah, it's like just because the character is a female, what's wrong about, you know, that's reverse sexism. So, you know, he stands by it. And yeah, I think they're still playing this live. I think it's driving, and I just enjoy the synths coming in for the chorus. Beautiful track for me.
I thought the beginning of the song, when it literally would have started before the kind of, I really can't tell what the extra, let's say, bits in songs from Psychedelic Furs are, because you're like, is it a synth? Is it some kind of random instrument? Because doesn't Todd Rundgren bring in, like, I saw like cello and marimba, and I'm like, yeah, right, okay, marimba, I don't think I would have got there very easily. But right at the beginning, it literally sounded like it could have been a song from a mid-noughties indie band like Killers Like Block Party, just the way it sounds so clean. And simultaneously Joy Division as well, like, you can tell that's the inspiration too. I think on first listen I didn't like it. I much preferred it on second listen, because for me, yeah, it's not an immediate, there's too much going on for it to be immediate, but yeah, by the second listen I did quite like it.
I will say there are bands who grow on you. Like when I first played that Best Of, I think maybe only two or three songs sort of shone out, but that's why I love going back, because even now I go back and I think, okay, I never gave that song a chance. I think because there's so many different people playing on it, you find new things to fall in love with. But moving on to a pop song, maybe the most poppy of all the songs, and the only other song I knew, and maybe the only other song you would hear, which is Love My Way from 1982, the Todd Rundgren Forever Now. And yeah, it was basically, the story is that they wrote the song, they're in the studio, and then randomly in the corner with some marimbas, and then Todd said, should we give that a go? So they started playing the synth riff on the marimbas, and I thought, yeah, that works. So
that's where he brought it in.
It was just already there. It was just spontaneous. It's the most poddish song, but I think, I don't know why this is not a top 10 single. I think if you look at the musical landscape of 1982, 1983, you're thinking, why was this not a hit? I don't get it. There's a great cover by the Polyphonic Spree, if for further listening. But yeah,
I don't know.
But what are your thoughts?
So this is another song that I'd saved of the four. I can tell you that the other two were Pulse and Don't Believe. One of them from the 2020 album, indeed. I love this song. I think this is their most accessible song by far. And well, yeah, maybe the reason why it wasn't so big is just because, like, it did sound, I guess, like a lot of other bands in that period. I think it's fantastic. I love the Glockenspiel. Well, I've put the Glockenspiel sound, but it's a marimba. But the one thing I find, it fades out slightly abruptly. It's just like that leaves it kind of a bit imperfect to me. But I got into it immediately, and having not listened to it in years. So yeah, I'm surprised that it's not better known.
It was used in Call Me By My Name.
Oh, is that the one they danced to?
Yeah, and even Metzen's going to see the band live, so I'm hoping that gave it.
Right, okay, so maybe that's why I recognise it. But okay,
I've not seen the Spotify, but I've seen it must have given it
I think it's different. So yeah, on Spotify it's the biggest, like, yeah, three times more than Pretty in Pink.
Oh wow!
But on Tidal, oh no, it is also. It is also the top one. What's different then? Oh yeah, what's different is that the third one on Tidal is Heartbreak Beat, whereas the third one on Spotify is The Ghost in You.
That's covered by The Counting Crows. Mm. So same album. This is back to being seedy and angry, Psychedelic Furs. This is President Gas, which is about Ronald Reagan.
Of course it is. Yeah.
And yeah, doing anything he will do to get power. He's on the left, he's on the right. He's trying to do anything he can. And I love the line, it's sick, the price of medicine. Beautiful. But yeah, it's what you mentioned, the cello. Yeah, this out of nowhere comes this like cello breakdown, and there's these fast acoustic guitars. It's experimental, it's intriguing. And this, the first time I heard this, I thought, oh, what is this? Then the more times I play it, I fall in love with different elements. And yeah, I think this is up. I think Richard Butler has this in his top three songs he's ever recorded. What are your thoughts?
I love this song. I've written, ooh, cheeky, sexy guitars matching his sexy voice. Though the guitars reminded me a little bit of 80s Matchbox. Actually, again, like just the guitars, but you have this very kind of smooth bass and everything else and drums going on in the background, but the guitars are quite discordant. And I think that is why the song works, because the chorus, it starts going a bit poppy, but then those guitars come back in and you're like, oh no, this is just a fucking weird song. And the second half again changes in a way that you're not expecting. Yeah, I love the song, but the lyrics are so generic. It's kind of like, ooh, I am writing about politics. You have to have a party when you're in a state like this. I went to look at him, like he's literally saying nothing of substance, but sure, President Gas. Okay, oh, gas Americans, because of course, haha, gasoline. So I can't take his political stylings very seriously, but I love the song.
But I will say, I mean, if you just moved to America, it's quite brave to release a single anti-Ronald Reagan.
Especially when you think about the arc and what happened to them when they were critical in America, yeah.
I know, yeah, but even the chorus is like, President Gas. No.
I guess it's not so big, people aren't going to be so annoyed about it, right? Was it a single?
No, well, I think it was, but yeah, as I said, it's not commercial at all, I think, compared to Love My Way. And then taking a step to when they kind of wanted to be successful. So this is Mirror Moves, and instantly the production has changed. The band now is just John Aston and the Butlers, basically, and then special guests. I think the keyboard player from The Cure was in the band for a while, and they just have rotating people. And yeah, so this is the Ghost in You, which is a song I didn't know until I bought the best of, and I think it's kind of okay successful in America slightly. But yeah, this is glossy. It's less edgy, I guess. This is probably as like with Love My Way as poppy as it could be, but I think, but it's got a great melody to it. I quite like the chorus. I just felt like if this was produced differently, for me, it needs to be reproduced by somebody else. I think that they're going for Primetime Radio too much of a single. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that synth line is really annoying. That and the synth line at the beginning, I really didn't like it. I thought the chorus and the harmonies were great. I thought they were stirring, but that synth line, oh, it really annoyed me. And I was like, okay, well, you know, with one of the U2 songs, I had to listen to it a second time, and I listened to it again. I was like, nope, it's just, yeah, it's not for me, I'm afraid. But I was surprised to see that Robert Smith from The Cure said this was one of his 5 favorite albums of all time, Mirror Moves, apparently.
Yeah, no, it's got some decent material in it, but you know when you're a fan of a band and you've heard them being produced by other producers, it's like Todd Rundgren would have done better with this, like other producers. And it does feel like this is a band who just moved to America and basically said to their management, how do we get onto radio?
Or, or a record company, which is like, we'll make you guys huge. You guys sound like this. Well, sorry, Americans that listen.
But yeah, interesting that there's no synth player in the band. And then obviously the synth suddenly became the main instrument. I don't know how that happens. So yeah, so for me, it was a grower. Like, I had to hear it a few times, but now I enjoy it.
Over underrated.
So moving on to Heaven, which was a single. I think it just scraped the top 40 in the UK, but again, I think they thought this was going to be a big hit. So for me, I think this is a great mid-80s pop song. It's got a beautiful guitar hook, and it's catchy as fuck, and I don't know why this was not successful. I listen to it and I hear The Killers instantly. I think that Mr. Butler still loves it, and I think they were shocked when this was a flop. But alas,
I am not shocked it was a flop, because I thought this was annoying as hell as well. I wrote that, not with the previous one, but this one, I wrote, this is cynically 80s to me. It sounds fake. The piano is especially terrible, but I don't like the synth line either. And the guitar solo, oh my God, I really disliked it. And I think, as you put this in chronological order, I was like, where's the post-punk sound? Like, I can hear it, the bass is still there. But I'm like, where's the post-punk sound? Where's, like, you know, that pop sensibility that's in Love My Way, or the wackiness of President Gas? Like, that isn't there anymore. And yeah, for me, Yeah, I was like, God, Robert Smith likes this? Just, I'm surprised. I've much preferred the other three albums you've put forward so far.
But as a fan of pop, I do think it's a good pop song. But so yeah, I do find as a pop fan, I don't know why that wouldn't have been played on the radio in 1984.
But I guess it depends. Do other people have similar sensibilities to me or to you? If they find it annoying, then maybe not.
So after that, they did the album when they re-recorded Pretty in Pink called Midnight to Midnight,
which got panned. Right,
that, I saw this. If you like the sound of the 80s, bad 80s, listen to that. There's some fucking horrendous guitar on it, and they grew mullets and they became a typical mid to late 80s band, and then they basically checked in on themselves and thought, what the fuck happened to us? We were like a cool indie band. So
yeah, because they've gone back on it as well, haven't they? Like, they've gone back on the album. They're like, it was vapid and awful.
Yeah basically, and they wrote like horrible love ballads and with terrible fucking videos. So yeah, again, you know, I guess that's the management just pushing them in that direction. I think they were playing the bigger audiences, but yeah, it just like they lost all their street cred. So they basically reinvented themselves, and I think they worked with Stephen Street.
Oh, okay.
For this single, so this is All That Money Wants, and this was just on their Best Of album. I think 1988. It's not on a studio album, and yeah, it's just a different. It's just back to being, I guess, more indie. It does sound like that late indie to guitar, when it is very much like the British indie sort of guitar, like ding, ding, ding. And they brought back Vince Elli, the drummer, again for this album and the song. They tried to get rid of the gimmicks. It's got a decent synth line. I don't adore it, but it just seems to be a lot of the psychedelic fans' favourite song. So what is your opinion?
I didn't look at the lyrics too closely, but the fact that it's called All That Money Wants, do you think it's a comment on? Yeah,
it is about the music industry.
Yeah, because I initially got it wrong, and I thought this was from the Minutes to Midnight album, and I was like, what? But they have a song criticizing money on an album. Yeah, but then I was like, oh, afterwards, fine. The beginning really, really reminded me of The Stranglers again, and a specific song that I have the riff in my head, and I can't think of which one it is. I'm gonna have to go and listen through some Stranglers albums to tell you. I much preferred this to the Mirror Moves songs. Mm-hmm. And I wrote, surely this sound influenced bands like James. The guitar sound to me really did sound like James. It grew on me, definitely on the second listen as well, but yeah, it wasn't one of my favorites. Again, it's still maybe too jangly for me.
So this is the final album of the first version of Psychedelic Furs from 1991, and this is In My Head. That album sounds more like the previous song. It's more jangly cellos and less synths. This sounds like 1985, but as a guy who likes guitars and synths, as you previously heard, to me this is a fantastic track, and I don't know how it wasn't a single. This is just an album track, and again, I can hear the Killers and a lot of those bands copying this. Like I know, looking at the internet, I don't know if you tried that before.
Yeah, tell me more. Where do I go? What do I do?
So bands like the Horrors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like Airborne Toxic Event, even British Sea Power, they've mentioned Psychedelic Furs, and I can hear this on a lot of their work. So yeah, for me, this is a glossy mid-80s synth rock track, and I do really, really like it. I know that you won't like it maybe because it's quite melodic and you don't like synths and guitar too much.
So I preferred this to the Mirror Moves tracks. And I thought the beginning sounded like Blondie with more keyboards was my note. But it was kind of this point where I'm like, these songs are all starting to sound a little bit the same. And when you look at like the people who criticize the Psychedelic Furs, they do make that point. I think this is obviously song 9, but I was like, I'm now starting to have difficulty telling these songs apart, which I think when you move from, you know, the first song on your playlist from India to President Gas, you really can't say that. Like they're five quite different sounds. But in the latter half, I'm like, it is a kind of jangly pop synth 80s something sound where I'm like, okay, I feel like I get it. I get this is what you sound like. And yeah, I listened to it twice and I was like, this isn't unfortunately any longer making as much of an impact on me.
This doesn't sound like the rest of the album, I would say. The rest of the album is more acoustics and cellos. As I say, this stands out a lot. Maybe that's why they didn't do it as a single, because they didn't want people to get the wrong idea. Who knows? But yeah, that's fine. Like this is a band in 1991. This does not sound like 1991.
No, that's true.
Especially for a band who still lived in America.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about that when I was listening to you too as well, of like, gosh, this is the sound of the 80s, but not the sound of the 80s when you listen to kind of Joshua Tree and stuff like that, which is quite interesting, but there we go.
And then we're moving on to 28 years later. Of course, that's how long it takes to release another Stag. So you often
they took notes from the Cars, you know? They were like, we need a big break.
So obviously, yeah, we mentioned this, the Love But Love in 95 and 97. Richard Butler has a solo album, I think, in around 1999, which is an electronic album.
Is it good?
It's got some moments.
Okay.
And then they got back together, I think, in 2001 and did a tour with Dren Astin, the guitar player. Mm-hmm. And then they wrote four songs, including Wrong Train, which they played live. And then, for reasons unknown, they didn't actually record anything for another 20 years. Mm-hmm. So this was written in 2000 with Dren Astin.
I'm really surprised.
And then it took him like that long. I know that basically after the 90s, I think that Richard Butler wanted to walk away from the music industry and he got divorced, which is what the song's about.
It's the wrong, you know, that's it. I was thinking, oh, it's another song about a train, but it was the wrong.
And he's an artist now. I think he's an artist. And he says that if you ask him what his job is, he will say he's an artist.
Oh wow! Even though they're touring,
yeah. You see, like if you go on the internet, he exhibits loads of art. That's his main job, and then yeah, I think this is a secondary thing that maybe his brother asked him to do it for him. I don't know.
Or maybe like you know, being an artist is also not something the way you make a shit ton of money,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Normally,
unless you're very lucky, but
So I don't know why it took him 20 years to actually bother to go in the studio, but they finally did, and this came out 2020, and everyone was surprised at how good it was because. I said, you know, he must be, 65? But if you listen to a song, it does not sound drastically different than he did in the 80s and 90s. His voices stay the same.
His voice is amazing on this song. It sounds really lush and epic. And yeah, I have to say, I much preferred this sound than the kind of albums before. And I think the guitars sound great with the synths, and there's something making rain sounds, which is, I guess, unsurprising. One of the albums called Made of Rain, I really enjoyed that as like a kind of nice light touch. And it made me go and re-listen to Don't Believe from the same album. That's a great song. Like, I prefer Don't Believe to this one. That is such a great song. I think it's because somehow, I don't know if this is me kind of making stuff up or it's just intangible, I feel like they bring the post-punk elements into this much more than in those kind of mid to late 80s albums. There's an essence there that was missing in those albums that I kind of find here. So, yeah, who would have thought? A bit like The Cars as well, because The Cars, they have a couple of good songs on that last album too. Maybe, more than a couple of good songs. It's surprising that when a band who makes albums from kind of 80 to 90, you might prefer something from the 2020. Who would have thought? In COVID times as well.
Seriously, listen to that album in full because I was not expecting anything. Because, you know, when it's a band from the 80s releasing an album, it's like, yeah, okay, here's the cash in.
Yeah. No, it's great.
But yeah. I love the line, a wife that hates me, so does her boyfriend. But, but yeah.
And looked at the lyrics.
But it's got three great singles. Yeah, Don't Believe is a single. I'm hopefully they will make another album. If right now for 28 years, I'm not sure they will be alive. So make it happen.
Guys.
But yeah, but looking at stats wise, like they've only sold 1.8 million albums.
That is surprising, given that they have 1.5 million monthly listeners on Spotify. Over 1.5 million, yeah.
But yeah, so they've never had a top 20 album. This doesn't make sense to me. Bands like Kajagoogoo have sold more albums and stuff than it does.
Yeah.
I don't get, because they were in Columbia. They weren't like it was a major label. Mm-hmm. So I just found it really interesting because to me, obviously I'm a bit more of a fan of pop music, but I can hear Heaven, Love My Way, and think these are for me like a top 20 single. It's very strange. And yeah, to come back after 20 years with Wrong Train to fantastic. Love But Love is really interesting. You know, you like House Owners now, but I would say Am I Wrong and Fall to Tears, also great songs. If this will get one person to listen to the Psychedelic Furs, then do it. They're still touring, mainly in America, but it still comes to the UK occasionally. Check them out.
I hope so, because I heard from George today that our previous guest, George Thurley, that since listening to our Prague episode, Tidal keeps recommending him Prague to listen to. So clearly we, us and Jos Norris, are having a bit of an impact on people's listening habits.
So would you call them underrated or overrated, the Psychedelic Furs?
See, once I saw they had 1.5 million monthly listeners, I was like, oh, they're not underrated. Like, that's a really big, I think if it was around the, I don't know, like 300,000, maybe. But I'm like, that is a lot of people. And maybe it is people from Call Me By Your Name and people who still enjoyed John Hughes films. But this playlist was much more of a mixed bag. Like the U2 one, I felt fairly kind of, let's say, mostly neutral about it. This one, like the songs that I loved, I adored. And the songs that I didn't like, I really didn't like. So I think in terms of consistency, like I wouldn't call them overrated. No, not at all. Like they definitely deserve to be better known. But I wouldn't quite call them underrated, though I might change my mind if I go and listen to their debut album and a few other albums in more depth. So, you know, come back to me again later.
I'm just having a quick, I'm just comparing them to their contemporaries. Mm-hmm. So The Cure has 17 million.
Yeah, of course they do.
U2 20. But think of an average band from the mid-80s.
Human League?
Ice House. Yeah, Ice House.
I've never heard of Ice House.
Million. In Excess, well, it's all getting big, aren't they? Yeah. Because to me, I thought 1.5 was, but I reckon that will probably just be Love My Way. That's annoying thing about the stat, isn't it? It doesn't say what's been listened to. Like, are they anyone listening to the album? Or does people coming in listen to Pretty and Pink and Love My Way and getting the fuck out of there?
Honestly, like, I think Spotify figured out, like, give people more stats and they will enjoy it, right? At the end of the year. And I love getting my monthly, you know, I've listened to the most with Tidal. Although I have to say, like, there was a song from the band Magnus, the kind of Belgian supergroup, that I listened to a lot. And you know when you listen to a song a lot and then it kind of skips to the next, but then you just skip back. And it ranked the song that kept playing after the song I listened to more higher in my most listened to. And I was like, come on. I did put that song on repeat sometimes. So I don't know how accurate these things are. But anyway. But no, I mean, I think 1.5 million, that's huge for any band, right? I feel like if you have over a million people across the world who have Spotify listening to one or a couple of your songs, I mean, yeah, well, four times it was me, right? Four times it was me not realizing.
You have access to countries, so you can tell me what countries it is.
Yes, I can tell you.
So Strang is 3 million, it's a double M. But yeah, Japan, Japan's saying 225 million. No, so it's like thousands.
it's a pretty classic list. So it's LA up the top, almost double as many as London. So yeah, bigger in LA for sure. Then good old Mexico City, then New York City, and then Sydney. Really up close on New York City, actually. So really much in other parts of the Anglophone world and the Spanish speaking world rather than the UK.
Interesting.
I guess are they a kind of cult college radio style band in America? Maybe they're seen like that.
Yeah, so for me as a new wave junkie, a post-punk junkie, I was like, what, why? Yeah, I don't see why they're not as big as the Stranglers or
Speaking of the Stranglers, the song is No Mercy, by the way.
Okay,
go and listen to No Mercy and see how it sounds.
Interesting, because they've got a song called No Mercy too, the old Furs.
Ah, but are they like No Mercy, the boy band from the noughties?
It would be amazing if that's where they got a name from. Strangers or Psychedelic Furs song. Who
knew? Who knew? Where did he go, my lovely? Anyway.
Where did he come from? Where did he go?
So, Fran, any final thoughts for our listeners on this Thursday evening?
My final thoughts are to please listen to other songs because, again, you know, these bands have hundreds of songs. This is just 10. And, you know, my point, and I am aware, but I've chosen songs that I love. But most of, like, the first fans love songs like Dumb Waiters and Sister Europe, which I fucking can't stand. So maybe give those a try, because if you don't like
is what I was going to say. I think between us, like, you know, we liked different elements of it. So I think actually your playlist is fairly wide ranging. So I would say if you listen to one or two songs on this base and you don't like, try one or two more, because it's varied enough. But I will say that there is a certain sound of theirs which does get a bit repetitive, but keep at it. There's more to it.
if you've got time and you want to get into it, then the love will come back. The reason I don't have some of these other big hits that people like is because they're quite sexy. And as I mentioned before, I'm not the biggest fan of the sax.
Sexy is not sexy.
Sexy, yeah. So a little bit of sax is fine, but sometimes it's, oh God. And that's what happens also with Midnight to Midnight is Heartbreak Beak is a lot of 80s sax. And I'm imagining a lot of cocaine, a lot of sax, a lot of groupies.
I mean, 2 out of 3 ain't bad, right?
we love a sax. I will
finish off by saying that the name Psychedelic Furs, what it conjures up to me is Jonathan Rhys-Meyers' character in Velvet Goldmine. So, you know, given that we've talked a lot about films, that's a great film. Go watch it.
Their name does come from Winners and Furs, which I think is that film based on, isn't it? Based on Lou Reed and Bowie, isn't it?
It's based on Velvet Underground. Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's clearly like a Bowie-esque kind of person. But yeah, that was, again, another good film that I saw ages ago and can barely remember. But just remember enjoying staring at Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. So, you know, for you two, go stare at Larry Mullen Jr. For this, absolutely nothing to do with the band. We'll go and stare at Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. Go and stare at some nice-looking men, everyone. Whether you're straight or gay or bi. That's my message.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
See you.
And that's it, guys. You have completed another episode of Over Underrated, and we thank you. We thank you so much, because I know that you have already subscribed. You've followed us on all social media accounts, including Over Underrated Music Pod on Instagram and OU Music Pod on Twitter, as well as Blue Sky, if you're one of the lucky people to have that. And we are also on Gmail at overunderratedmusicpod@gmail.com. So get in touch if you have any questions, if you have any beefs, just update your diary at home, and we will see you, probably not see you, we'll be in your ears next time.